Thank you very much for the invitation. So I'm going to speak about some work that I did recently with my student, Maxime Gadieu, which you can find in this paper. So let me start by just reminding you of some terminology. So I'll be speaking about event horizons. And the standard property of an event horizon is that every point on a horizon belongs to a null geodesic that lies within the event horizon. And so these geodesics are called the generators of the horizon. A standard property of horizon generators, which more or less follows from the definition, is that a generator cannot have a future endpoint. So once the generator is in the horizon, it cannot leave the horizon to the future. Now, generators, of course, can have past endpoints. So here's a picture of an example of that. So this is just the usual Penrose diagram showing spherically symmetric gravitational collapse. And in blue here, you see the event horizon. And this red dot here is a past endpoint of all of the horizon generators. So this red dot is sitting at the origin of spherical symmetry. And if you look at this in three dimensions, it looks like the picture on the right, where in blue you see some of the generators of the horizon. And this red dot looks just like the vertex at the origin of a light cone. Now, of course, the space-time is perfectly smooth at this red dot, and there's nothing to stop you extending the horizon generators to the past, as null geodesics, and you can do that in a perfectly smooth way. So each geodesic is smooth as we go through the red dot. But if we do that, then once they go past the red dot, then those geodesics are no longer in the horizon. So this purple cone down here, consisting of these extensions of the generators to the past, that this is no longer in the event horizon. And on the left here, you see the same extension of those generators on the Penrose diagram. So as generators, the red dot is a past endpoint. So in this talk, I'll be discussing non-smoothness of event horizons. So something I should emphasize right at the start is that throughout my talk, I'll be assuming that space-time is smooth. So any non-smooth aspects of horizons that I discuss has got nothing to do with non-smoothness of space-time, because space-time is smooth. Now, a second textbook property of an event horizon is this theorem here, which says that an event horizon is an achronal continuous hypersurface. So I remind you that achronal means that no two points of the horizon are time-like separated. So if we just go back to this picture here, if we pick a blue point up here and a purple point down here, those two points are time-like separated. But of course, these purple points do not belong to the horizon. If I pick two blue points, then the blue points are not time-like separated. So the horizon is achronal. The second part of this theorem, saying that the horizon is a continuous hypersurface, sounds kind of unremarkable, but what's interesting is what it does not tell us. It doesn't tell us that the horizon is smooth, and in fact, it does not even tell us that the horizon is differentiable, and that's because it is not true, except in very special cases. Now, of course, those special cases are the cases that we spend most time thinking about, specifically the case corresponding to a time-independent black hole, for example, the Kerr black hole, where the horizon is smooth. But once you go outside of this time-independent situation, generically, horizons are not smooth. And so in this talk, I'll be discussing this question, what is the nature of the non-smoothness of an event horizon? Okay, so let me start by discussing some quite old work, which kind of sets an upper bound on how non-smooth the horizon might be. So some time ago, well, I guess almost 30 years ago, Kruschel and Galloway constructed examples of space-times for which the event horizon is non-differentiable on a dense set. So in other words, if you pick a point on the horizon, then you can find points arbitrarily nearby at which the horizon is not differentiable. In other words, points at which you cannot draw a tangent plane to the horizon. Now they constructed these examples in two ways. One was just by deleting sets of points from Minkowski space. If you do that, you can create non-trivial black hole region and with a non-trivial horizon. And choosing the set you delete appropriately, you can get the horizon to have this property. Another possibility is to apply a conformal transformation to map the set you've deleted off to infinity. And then one can construct asymptotically flat spacetimes, which are globally hyperbolic with this same property. Now they're not, in the words of the authors, they said these are very artificial, in particular that they don't satisfy any particular equations of motion, and null infinity in their examples is not complete. So you could object to them on those grounds. But nevertheless, they do set a kind of upper marker for just how bad things might be in general. Now, second important result from around the same time is this theorem of Beeman-Krolak, which says various things. I've just highlighted two things from two of their results. Firstly, they prove that an event horizon is differentiable at some point P if and only if P lies on exactly one generator. And secondly, if we have a point lying on more than one generator, then that is necessarily an endpoint. And if we go back to my picture here, you can see that in action. So this red dot here lies on more than one generator. All the generators go through this red dot. And so according to the theorem, the horizon is not differentiable there, and indeed it isn't. You can't draw a tangent plane at that red dot. And furthermore, that red dot lies on more than one generator. The theorem says it should be an endpoint, and it is an endpoint. So that's how the theorem works in that example. Interestingly, the converse to this second point is not true. So it's not true that every endpoint lies on more than one generator, and we may see examples of that later on. Okay, so a bit of notation. I'll write H end for the set of past endpoints of horizon generators. And over the years, people have studied various examples of event horizons in dynamical situations and looked at their non-smooth features. And these might be either simple toy models or perhaps numerical simulations. But what's been found in various examples that people have looked at is that this set of endpoints has a certain structure. It consists of a two-dimensional space-like set, which is called the crease set, at which pairs of generators enter the horizon. So each point in the crease set lies on two generators. And the boundary of this two-dimensional space-like set is a line of caustic points. And we can think of a caustic point as, loosely speaking, a point at which infinitesimally nearby generators intersect. But I imagine most of you are familiar with the definition of caustic points in terms of focusing and conjugate points and so on. But let's just stick with this informal definition for this talk. So what does this actually look like? So of course it's hard to draw pictures of event horizons in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So let me suppress a dimension and show how it looks in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So here's a possible event horizon for a black hole formed in gravitational collapse in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So here these lines here are the horizon generators. And you can see that down here is the crease set in purple. And you can see that two generators are entering the horizon at each point of the crease set. And the boundary of the crease set in 2 plus 1 dimensions is this pair of red caustic points. shown here. So that's how it looks if we go down a dimension. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, we can't draw the full event horizon, but we can just draw the crease set. So we already discussed spherically symmetric gravitational collapse, but if we break the spherical symmetry and look at an asymmetric gravitational collapse, then the crease set, at least in simple examples, has this kind of structure. It looks like a disk. So at each point on this disk, two generators will enter the horizon, and the boundary of that disk is a circle of caustic points. Another nice example to look at is the case of a black hole merger. And let's consider not a head-on merger with any kind of symmetry. Let's look at a fairly asymmetric merger, a non-axisymmetric black hole merger. For example, two Kerr black holes. So a few years ago, Roberto Emperin and collaborators introduced a nice model for studying the event horizon in this setup, which is valid in the extreme mass ratio limit, where one of the black holes is much bigger than the other one. So the idea is that when one black hole is much bigger, then from the perspective of the small black hole, the large black hole essentially has zero curvature. And so you can treat the horizon of the large black hole essentially as a Rindler horizon. And so the problem reduces to studying a small black hole falling across a Rindler horizon. And you can do that by constructing a null hypersurface in the spacetime of the small black hole, which asymptotes to a Rindler horizon. And that's what's shown here in the left. This is a figure from their paper. So this shows a picture in the rest frame of the small black hole with time running vertically upwards. In green here, you see some of the generators of the horizon of the small black hole, which are rotating because this is a Kerr black hole. And then in black at late time, up here at late time, you can see the generators are approaching the a Rindler horizon. And at late time, some of the generators of that Rindler horizon you can see came from the small black hole, but most of them don't. The generators shown in black originated at the large black hole before the merger, which corresponds to this part of the horizon down here. So this is the large black hole pre-merger. This is the small black hole pre-merger. This is the final black hole post-merger. And so in this picture, you can see the horizon generators are all they're intersecting each other along this red line here. And so that line is the set of endpoints of the horizon generators in this merger. Which you can see exists on both the black holes before the merger. That if that sounds counterintuitive to you, remember that an event horizon is defined in a teleological way. So it's perhaps easiest to think about the event horizon in terms of evolving backwards in time, starting from a late time Rindler horizon and evolving backwards and seeing this red line form. So in the picture on the left, it looks like this red line is just a line. But in fact, if you zoom in on it, you discover it's not a line at all. It is actually a two-dimensional surface, which is shown here on the right. So this is a zoom in on that red line. And so if you zoom in, you discover that it has the structure of a two-dimensional strip shown in gray here. And that's the crease set in this example. It's this two-dimensional space-like surface. The blue lines at the edge of this surface are the lines of caustic points analogous to this red line up here. Okay, so those are some simple examples of this crease set in practice. So in these examples, the set of endpoints of the horizon generators is fairly simple. So one question we can ask is what features of these spacetimes lead to this simple structure for the endpoint set, and what other structures are possible? So to make progress, question. Yes, Laurent?
Yeah, just a modular question before you go to the detailed description. Here you're talking about the grid sets or these singularities as geometrical singularities. Can you say a word of what happens if you couple? Because you said the space-time is smooth, so is something radical is going to happen if you couple matter or, you know, let's say photon fields, null matter to this
no,
geometry?
No, I mean, the things I'll be describing are fairly general properties of null hypersurfaces in smooth space-time, so that it doesn't really matter
Doesn't matter.
where that space-time comes from. So if you like, this is like the chapter in the GR textbook which is discussing causal structure but hasn't imposed the Einstein equations. There's not really any difference here between vacuum gravity and gravity with matter, because we don't care about field equations at this point.
That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, will the scalar field propagating on this geometry feel any, will it be regular, will it be singular?
No, because the geometry is perfectly smooth. If you tried to set up something like a characteristic initial value problem using this surface, then of course you would run into trouble because your initial surface is not smooth then. But if you set up a standard Cauchy problem starting from some smooth surface, then it's not going to care too much about this fact that the event horizon here is not smooth, I think. Any more questions?
Actually, Harvey, yes, I have a question. So in the drawing you did at the beginning, therefore, the line in part, the dot in red there, in this case, in which I can think of it as really shrinking, so this is a caustic point, right? It's not a crease set.
Yeah, that's a caustic point, yeah.
Okay.
Correct.
Thanks.
So in this example, there is no crease set. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So as we've seen, things in there's this result I mentioned where things could be very bad, but when you look at explicit examples, they don't turn out to be so bad. So what is true in these specific examples that's responsible for this fairly nice structure? We're going to make some assumptions to make progress and explain this. So one assumption I hope is fairly benign, which is that space-time is globally hyperbolic. We need that in order to predict anything. The key assumption is really this one, which is that the event horizon is smooth at late time. So the picture to have in mind here is we have some gravitational collapse or a black hole merger to form a black hole, which then settles down at late time to a Kerr solution. And so at late time, the horizon is going to be smooth, unless we start doing something crazy like sending gravitational waves in at arbitrarily late time to disrupt it. We're not going to do that. We'll assume that at late time, everything is smooth. And more technically, what that means is that we're assuming there exists a Cauchy surface sigma to the future of the endpoint set, such that the intersection of sigma with H, the event horizon, which we'll call H star, so this corresponds to a late time cross section of the event horizon, we're assuming this is smooth. As I said a few minutes ago, we're not making any assumptions about equations of motion. and so with these assumptions, we're able to make some progress proving things in general. And the way we do that is we relate this endpoint set to another mathematical object that has been studied previously, which is something called the past null cut locus of H star. So let me spend a few minutes explaining what that is. For this description, this surface H star could be any two-dimensional smooth space-like surface. You could forget about the connection with black holes for the moment. So let's take such a surface shown in green here and consider a null geodesic in blue, which is emitted orthogonally to that surface. Now, locally, near H star, this null geodesic cannot be deformed into a time-like curve back to H star. So over here, there's no time-like curve taking this point here back to H star. But if I go sufficiently far along this null geodesic, I might eventually reach points for which it is possible to find a time-like curve back to H star. So this yellow curve here is a time-like curve back to H star. And so the first point along this geodesic, beyond which such time-like curves do exist, is called a null cut point along that geodesic. So this red dot here is a null cut point along this blue geodesic. And so then the null cut locus of H star is the set of all of these null cut points along all of these geodesics. So that's what a null cut locus is, and in purple here is perhaps what that might look like. And so what we show in our paper is essentially the endpoint set of a horizon is the null cut past null cut locus of the late time cross section of the horizon. And so understanding the endpoint set reduces to understanding properties of this null cut locus. Now, this null cut locus is analogous to something that is very well studied in Riemannian geometry, which is simply called a cut locus. So in Riemannian geometry, a cut locus is defined by starting from a surface in a Riemannian manifold and shooting geodesics orthogonally to it. Locally, they will minimize distance back to the surface, but beyond some point, they may fail to minimize distance. And the set of points beyond which that first happens forms the cut locus in Riemannian geometry. And this is a very well-studied, very traditional thing to study in Riemannian geometry. And there are examples which show that it can be very complicated. So there are examples, for example, where the cut locus is a fractal. But surprisingly recently, it was shown that it can be decomposed into parts which have a simpler structure. So that was shown in 1998. And so what we did in our paper is essentially we obtained a Lorentzian analog of the Riemannian results of these guys. So I shall now explain those results. Okay, so well, first I should tell you one more thing that's a standard property of the null cut locus, which is that if you have a point in a null cut locus lying on exactly one generator, then that point must necessarily be a caustic point. Or in the language of black holes, if we have an endpoint on the horizon that lies on exactly one generator, then that endpoint must be a caustic point. So that means we can divide endpoints into two classes as follows. So in the first class, we put all of the caustic points. And in the second class, we'll put all of the non-caustic points. And then let's subclassify the non-caustic points as follows. So if we have a non-caustic point that lies on exactly two generators, we'll call that a normal crease point. If we have a non-caustic point lying on exactly three generators, we'll call that a normal corner point. And then all the other non-caustic points we'll just put in one class. So with this classification, we prove the following, following very closely the Riemannian arguments. So we prove, firstly, that these normal crease points, the non-caustic points lying on exactly two generators, form a two-dimensional space-like submanifold, which we call the crease submanifold. These normal corner points form a one-dimensional space-like submanifold called the corner submanifold. And everything else, so that's all of these points on four or more generators plus the caustic points, this is where the complicated fractal mess might be. But although this set might be messy, it can't be too big. So we prove that the Hausdorff dimension of this set is no greater than one. So in particular, the dominant or the highest dimensional part of the endpoint set is always this this crease submanifold. And so that's the part we'll be mostly focusing attention on. So to explain the terminology, let me show you a picture. So we have these normal crease points forming a two-dimensional space-like submanifold, the normal corner points forming a one-dimensional space-like submanifold. Let's consider a cross-section through the horizon by taking its intersection with some Cauchy surface sigma. So if that Cauchy surface intersects the crease submanifold, then that intersection will generically be a one-dimensional line shown in green here, And the cross section of the horizon will look something like this. It will have a local structure where you have two smooth parts of horizon meeting along a crease. And you can see why the name crease is appropriate from this picture on the left. Similarly, if the Cauchy surface intersects the corner submanifold, then the horizon cross section will have a corner at which three smooth sections of horizon meet. So just like the corner of a tetrahedron or a cube. So at a corner, you have three creases emerging. good. Any questions at this point?
I have a question. So what is the difference between a corner and a caustic?
Good. So a corner is a point which lies on exactly three generators. A caustic, I can define it more precisely now, is we have this horizon cross-section H star. So a caustic is a point which is conjugate to H star along the generators. So in other words, you have a Jacobi field, which is tangent to H star, which vanishes at a caustic point. Okay. Or in more mathematical terms, at a caustic, at a crease or a corner, it's like a self-intersection of the horizon. It's where the horizon is an immersed submanifold but fails to be an embedded submanifold, whereas at a caustic, the horizon fails to be an immersed submanifold.
Okay, thanks.
So the next thing I want to talk about then is we sort of explained the structure of why you get this two-dimensional crease set in the example, the simple examples that I described earlier. So we've explained why that's general. It follows just from the assumption of smoothness at late time. What I want to do now is to look at these non-smooth features of horizons, these creases and caustics, from an evolutionary point of view. So how do they behave under time evolution? So to discuss time evolution, I need to introduce a time function. So I'm going to let tau be a time function. So it's, in other words, the surfaces of constant tau are Cauchy surfaces. I'll call a surface of constant tau sigma tau. So then if I take an intersection of sigma tau with H, then this is the this intersection is the cross-section of the horizon at time tau. Then this is going to have some arrangement of creases, corners, and caustics. Now, as tau varies, in other words, as we vary this surface, or as tau defines a foliation by constant time surfaces, and as we move through that foliation, then the arrangement of creases, corners, and caustics may undergo some qualitative change at some critical value of tau. And we call this, so we're following the terminology of the catastrophe theory literature due to Arnold and his school, we call this a perestroika, which means restructuring. So as an example, if I were to go back to this picture here, if you imagine constant time slices as being horizontal in this picture, there's going to be some first slice which just touches the horizon. And it's when it touches, it's going to touch so that it's tangent to the crease set. So this point of tangency between the constant time slice and the crease set is clearly corresponds to some interesting dynamical change in the space-time. In this example, it would be the formation of the black hole. So what we did is we classified these possible points of tangency. So where a constant time slice is tangent to the crease submanifold. So we call this a crease perestroika. And figured out what these things describe physically. So the way I'm not going to show you any of the analysis, but roughly speaking, what we do is the following. Is near this point of tangency, because we're at the crease submanifold, as I said before, a crease corresponds essentially to a self-intersection of the horizon. So near this point of tangency, the event horizon looks like the union, or part of the union, of two intersecting null hypersurfaces. And remember, there are two generators entering at each point of the Creaser manifold. So what we do is we, at this point of tangency, we introduce Riemannian normal coordinates such that the time coordinate is orthogonal to the constant time slice we're working with. And then we just write down the equation of two arbitrary null hypersurfaces in these coordinates, impose the condition that this surface is tangent to our constant time slice. And by doing that, we're able to determine an exact local description of the event horizon around this point of tangency. And it turns out there are three qualitatively different possibilities describing three physically distinct situations. So to describe them, let me just shift tau so that the perestroika, that this point of tangency occurs at tau equal to zero. So the first one is the one I just described, which is gravitational collapse. So this picture here shows the evolution of the cross-section of the event horizon in a completely generic gravitational collapse situation. So this is at time zero. This is the time when the horizon nucleates. But if we now look at very small positive tau, so this is a very short time after the horizon has nucleated, this is what the horizon looks like. Or more precisely, this is the shape of the horizon. And you can see it looks like two smooth intersecting surfaces. Each of these we can show has a paraboloidal shape. And this green line of intersection is a crease running around the middle here. And you can see that the whole thing looks like a flying saucer. Similar things are seen in other situations in the catastrophe theory literature where they're also referred to as flying saucers. So you can't blame us for this terminology. So this, I emphasize, this is what a black hole looks like at the instant it forms in a generic gravitational collapse. And using our description, we can calculate various geometrical properties of this. So for example, one can see that the length of this crease, in other words, the circumference, which by the way is generically is an elliptical shape, that scales as the square root of tau for small tau. The angle between the two smooth sections of horizon which meet at the crease also scales as the square root of tau. And the area of the flying saucer scales as tau. And so in a generic collapse, typically you'd nucleate many of these and they will grow and merge and eventually settle down to a single black hole. So that's the first kind of perestroika. The second one describes something very different, which is the collapse of a hole in the event horizon. So it's been known for a long time that there are examples of gravitational collapse or black hole mergers where some choices of time function can lead to a brief period where the event horizon has the topology of a torus. It has a hole in it. Now the hole in the torus collapses quickly. In fact, it collapses superluminally. So in these examples, so this is a picture shown on the left of, in this picture here in red, again, this is coming from our exact description. In red, you see the event horizon. The black hole region here is the region outside the red surface. And in green here, you see that the hole in the horizon has got a crease running around the middle. Again, this is an elliptical shape. And this collapses superluminally. It's superluminal because the crease submanifold is space-like. And so the hole collapses. And this is the instant at which it collapses to zero size. So this is the special point of tangency of our constant time slice with the crease submanifold corresponds to this picture here. And so the hole here has collapsed to zero size. The yellow here is showing new generators which have entered the horizon between this picture, which is for slightly negative tau, and this picture, which is for tau equal to zero. And so these new generators have entered through the crease. Remember, at each crease point, two generators enter the horizon. One generator goes up here, one generator goes down here. And then if we go to slightly positive tau, these two smooth sections of horizon now move apart. the black hole region is the region between those two smooth sections. And so now the hole in the horizon has collapsed, and this could be now a horizon of spherical topology. I should emphasize here, these pictures are only showing part of the horizon. This is all a local description. This is all backed up by our equations in the Riemannian normal coordinates, and you can use them to calculate various geometrical properties of this process. So, for example, the length or circumference of this crease and this angle between the two smooth sections here scales as the square root of minus tau as tau approaches zero. Okay, the final example is also very interesting, which is the case of a black hole merger. So this is the third type of perestroika. And so this describes the merger of two locally disconnected sections of horizon. So this could be a merger of two black holes, or it could in fact just be two sections of one black hole, two portions of one horizon, which are coming close to each other and merging. That's another possibility. This is all local. So this is just before the merger. On the left, you see two sections of horizon. So this is one black hole, this is the other black hole. The black hole region lies to the left of this surface and to the right of this surface. You can see that just before the merger, each black hole has a section of crease on its horizon. And using our description, we can say that crease is a hyperbolic shape. This is the instant of merger. And you can see at the instant of merger, these two sections of crease, hyperbolic shape, the two hyperbole connect into this pair of straight lines, which would be the asymptotes to these hyperbole. These are creases, so new generators enter the horizon between this picture and this picture. They're shown in orange here. And so this is the instant at which the two black holes merge. And then for slightly positive tau, the horizon now is connected and expands in the transverse direction to form a bridge connecting the two black holes. So the black hole region now extends through this tunnel region. And you can see after the merger, a crease is still present. There are hyperbolic creases running along each edge of this bridge. In yellow here, you see new generators which have entered between this picture and this picture. And as before, we have equations describing all of this, so I can say that the angles at these creases, for example, scales as the square root of tau, that the thickness or height of this bridge scales as tau, and its width scales as root tau, and things like that. But I emphasize this is how black holes merge. This is the generic description of a black hole merger. It always involves the creases connecting in this way. Good. Any questions at this stage? Okay. So to move on. So this is now, I'm going to discuss something more speculative. Since this is the quantum gravity seminar, I thought maybe I should mention something quantum. So this is the speculative idea that maybe these creases, which are nice geometrical structures on an event horizon, maybe they contribute to black hole entropy. So there's this old idea that some or possibly all of black hole entropy is entanglement entropy arising from, well, the entanglement entropy of quantum fields across the horizon. And the way this works is that, as I'm sure most of you know, entanglement entropy is a divergent quantity in quantum field theory. But when you couple quantum field theory to gravity, that causes Newton's constant to also exhibit a divergence. And so basically the idea is that the divergence in Newton's constant in the bare black hole entropy cancels the divergence in the UV divergence in the entanglement entropy, and things work out in such a way that the total entropy is a finite quantity which is independent of the UV cutoff. So that's the basic idea. So that's just for the usual area law. But it's known that if you have an entangling surface with a crease in flat space, then there's a new kind of UV divergence which is present. It's a subleading UV divergence. And so if you were to repeat these kinds of ideas, that suggests that maybe a crease should also contribute to black hole entropy. And from the form of the flat space entanglement entropy at a crease, it's natural to guess that the contribution would look like this. So here we're considering a cross section of the horizon, which has a crease on it. This is an integral along that crease. L is the proper length along the crease. Omega is the angle of the two smooth sections of horizon which meet at the crease. So omega may vary with L. And we're dividing here by the Planck length. And this function F will depend on the quantum field theory in question. It does have some universal features. So for example, F is negative and F has a pole as omega tends to zero. Now you might think, this idea would be very hard to test. So I remind you that creases are only present in dynamical situations. So this proposal, to test it, you need to look at a dynamical situation. And secondly, this contribution to the entropy is subleading compared to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, because Bekenstein-Hawking scales as 1 over Planck length squared. This scales as 1 over Planck length. Now, whenever you have a crease, new generators are entering the horizon. And so Bekenstein-Hawking is certainly increasing. So you might think Bekenstein-Hawking would always dominate this. But in fact, there's at least one situation where that's not true, which is this collapse of the hole in the horizon that I described earlier. If you consider the crease, go back to it, this crease running around the hole in the horizon, in the collapse, the length of that crease tends to zero, but the angle also tends to zero. And because of this pole, it means that this divergence in the integrand cancels the fact that the length is going to zero. And so this contribution remains finite in that limit. And so after the crease has collapsed, of course, this is absent. And so this term is discontinuous in that collapse process. And so in order for this to be consistent with the second law, it would have to be a positive discontinuity. And it is, fortunately, because as I said, this function F turns out to be negative coming from subadditivity results in quantum field theory. Laurent?
Yeah, so I'm confused about one thing. You said the decrease is two-dimensional, but here you're tricking it as one.
Yeah, so remember, when you think about the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, we're thinking of a cross-section of the horizon. So here we're doing the same thing. When we take a cross-section of the horizon, we get a crease that looks like this. So it's a one-dimensional thing.
Oops. I thought the crease is as a non-degenerate metric, right?
It's space-like, yeah.
It's like, so it has an area.
It has an area, yes. In fact, I may say something about that towards the end. That's very interesting, I think, that area. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, okay. So here you're just taking a cut of the crease.
That's right, yeah.
Because in your origin, okay, because it could be that your cut is the crease. You're not doing that.
Yeah, that will be a very special cut. No, we're not doing that. We're looking at a generic cut which would intersect in a one-dimensional line.
And omega, so what you call omega, what do you mean the angle at the crease? The angle between the two?
Yeah, so it's the angle between these two sections, smooth sections, this one and this one.
So now it was, is that uniquely defined?
So this is all happening on a Cauchy surface. So the Cauchy surface you can think of as a Riemannian manifold, and this is a submanifold of that Riemannian manifold. Okay, any other questions?
And could you comment, because you say that there is also a contribution to black hole entropy or some UV divergences, but you went very far. Would it this work, and what did you mean by that?
You mean this stuff up here? Question about the motivation?
Is it Cassini-Huerta that should? Yeah, what is the context in which there is extra UV divergences due to crease,
because okay, so this is just a statement about quantum field theory. So if you consider the entanglement, how the entanglement entropy behaves across an entangling surface which has a crease, then so this is in four space-time dimensions. So there's a quadratic divergence, which gives you the area law, but then there's a linear divergence arising from the crease. So it's a sub-leading divergence.
What is the reference that first established that?
So it was first looked at in 2+1 dimensions, where instead of a linear divergence, it becomes a log, but it would be these guys here for 2+1 dimensions. And then in 3+1 dimensions, these papers here. There was quite a big industry back in about 10 years ago using ADS-CFT to calculate this kind of effect, which is what they were doing in these papers. Any other questions? Okay, so I'm going to move back now to more, less speculative stuff. So far, when I was describing the structure of this endpoint set, I was describing general results. I wasn't assuming any kind of notion of genericity or stability. But of course, it's a natural thing to ask which features of the endpoint set are stable under small perturbations. So in spherically symmetric collapse, as we saw right at the start, the endpoint set is a single caustic point. But if we perturb that space-time and break the spherical symmetry, then in the perturbed space-time, the endpoint set will have a non-trivial pre-submanifold. And so this single caustic point was an unstable structure or a non-generic structure. So in fact, some time ago, there was actually a nice paper by Shino and Koike, which tried to classify horizon endpoints, assuming stability or assuming a particular mathematical notion of genericity. And the way they did that was to use methods from catastrophe theory. So the notion of genericity they used was the notion that they needed to use in order to apply catastrophe theory techniques. And so their result is that generic endpoints fall into these various classes. So non-caustic endpoints are either points of double, triple, or even quadruple self-intersections of the horizon. So these double and triple intersections are what I've called creases and corners. Quadruple self-intersections can arise generically, but there can be special cases where these don't happen, so we didn't consider them. But in any case, these quadruple self-intersections will correspond to isolated points in space-time, so they're very low-dimensional sets. Perhaps more interesting for the stuff I'm going to discuss now is their classification tells us something about the caustic points, which I've said very little about so far. So according to their classification, caustic points on a horizon generically are of a particular type, which is called A3 in the catastrophe theory terminology. And these points lie on lines in space-time, which I'll describe in a moment. I just want to highlight that there is an open question here, which is how this notion of genericity that's used in this classification relates to a more physical notion of genericity, for example, genericity with respect to perturbations of the metric. That seems to be an open mathematical question. Anyway, let me describe these caustic points. So this is the generic kind of caustic point on a black hole horizon. So this is an A3 point. So an A3 caustic always lives on some, they fill out one-dimensional lines in space-time, space-like lines. And so if we consider a horizon cross-section by taking an intersection with a Cauchy surface, then generically that cross-section will have isolated A3 caustic points. So in order to draw a picture of that, it's convenient to imagine extending the horizon generators beyond their past endpoints so that they leave the horizon and drawing the picture of that extended horizon. If we do that, we get this picture on the left, which is the famous picture of a swallowtail surface. Okay, so this is a cross section through this extended horizon where we've extended the generators beyond their past endpoints. So up here is the A3 point, the tip of the swallowtail. And on the left here, emanating from that A3 caustic point are two lines, which are labeled A2 in this picture, this line here and this line here, where you can see the surface as a kind of cuspy feature. So an A2 point is a simpler kind of caustic point, and they fill out these lines on the horizon cross-section, or the extended horizon cross-section. And below that, you see a self-intersection. That will be a crease. Now, as I said, to get this picture on the left, we had to extend the horizon generators beyond their past endpoints. If we don't do that, and we just show the horizon generators themselves, then it corresponds to chopping off this feature here, and we just get the picture on the right. So this is what the actual horizon cross-section looks like, where it just has the single A3 point up here with a crease emanating from it. Okay, so here you see an A3 caustic point is a point at which a crease ends. Okay, so this is so creases don't always form closed loops, for example. They can end at caustic points. And as you approach the A3 point, the angle at the crease approaches pi, the crease flattens out. So an obvious question to ask when you look at this is that on the picture on the left, which was this extended horizon, we had these other kinds of caustic, these A2 type caustics with this cuspy feature. And you might wonder why an A2 caustic can't occur on an event horizon, according to this classification. So we couldn't find a simple answer to that in the literature. So we figured it out by working out that there's a canonical set of coordinates that catastrophe theory gives you, which are valid in the neighborhood of any caustic point. So you can write down the horizon in those coordinates, at least locally. You can write down the metric, get some information about the metric in those coordinates using the fact that these surfaces should be null in space-time. And using that, you can figure out that these two branches of this surface are always time-like separated. So an A2 caustic violates achronality. So it can certainly occur on a wavefront in space-time, but it can't occur on a horizon. That's the reason why not. And similarly, in 3+1 dimensions, there are three other more complicated types of caustic, which also can't occur on an event horizon for the same reason. It would violate achronality. So just as we discussed crease perestroikas, we can also discuss caustic perestroikas. So these are dynamical changes involving caustics, and they happen at instants when the surface of constant time is tangent to this line of A3 points. So we classified them, and there are two possibilities. So in the top row, starting off on the left, we have a section of horizon with a finite crease on it, which is two of these A3 endpoints. And as we evolve forwards in time, the crease shrinks. And this is the instant of the perestroika, where these two caustics merge into one, which then disappears. So this perestroika describes the shrinking away of a crease on the horizon, leaving a smooth section of horizon behind. The other possibility again starts with a crease. So this is just before the perestroika. Then at time zero, we nucleate a caustic point on that crease. That then bifurcates into two caustics, which move apart, leaving a smooth section of horizon in between them. So again, you're destroying crease in this process. So both of these perestroikas are processes by which caustics are involved in destroying a crease and making the horizon smoother. And that ultimately is how horizons become smooth, is through these two processes, by caustics forming or annihilating in pairs and destroying creases in the process. Good. All right. So now I'm going to end with some more speculative stuff. So I'm going to say something about a possible higher derivative contribution to black hole entropy. So in four dimensions of space-time, If you add, there's a particular term you can add to the gravitational action, which is the so-called Gauss-Bonnet term. This is the term whose integral would give you the Euler invariant in four dimensions. So this is a topological term you can add to the Einstein-Hilbert action in four dimensions. Because it's topological, it doesn't affect the equations of motion, but it has been argued that it does contribute to black hole entropy. And the contribution looks like this. So H here is the horizon cross-section. Mu here is the induced metric on the horizon cross-section. And R is the Ricci scalar of that induced metric. Gamma here is the coefficient of this Gauss-Bonnet term in the action. So this is what you have to add to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, according to these people. Now, of course, many of you will recognize that this thing here is on a smooth horizon. If H is a smooth surface, then this also is topological. This evaluates to 4 pi gamma times chi, where chi is the Euler number of the horizon cross-section. So this would be 2 for a spherical horizon, for example. Now, as I've been describing, generically, horizons are not smooth. So how would you make sense of this on a non-smooth horizon? Well, one possibility would be to regulate the horizon by defining this integral as a limit of smooth surfaces that converge to H. And since those surfaces are smooth, that means that this result will still hold. Okay, so if we regulate this integral in that way, this result will still be valid, and so this term will still be topological. Now, because it's topological, that means that this term is discontinuous in a process in which the horizon topology changes, such as black hole formation when chi increases, or black hole merger when chi decreases. And so because it's discontinuous in opposite directions in those two processes, it was argued by Sarkar and Wall that, in fact, only gamma equal to zero is consistent with the second law. So in other words, the second law of black hole mechanics says you can't have this Gauss-Bonnet term in the action, according to this argument. But notice that to make this argument, we had to take this approach of regulating this integral on the non-smooth horizon. And now we know the nature of the non-smoothness of the horizon. We could ask, does this integral actually need regulating? And the answer appears to be no. So if we look at a horizon near a crease or a caustic, then near a crease or a caustic, the horizon is piecewise smooth. And so there's no problem defining this integral as a Riemann integral. At an A3 caustic point, the Ricci scalar of the horizon, it turns out, is divergent, but the divergence is integrable. And so this still makes sense, even at a caustic point. And so this integral doesn't need regulating, in other words. Now, if you don't regulate it, it's no longer topological. And so this argument no longer applies, because this term is continuous now in black hole formation or merger. Now, you can still see that although it's continuous, this term is rapidly varying. And so it turns out you can still argue that there's going to be a violation of the second law if this is all that you're adding to the entropy. So if there are no higher order terms present in the entropy. But if you take an effective field theory perspective, where you say this is just a particular term that arises at two derivatives, and there are more terms involving four derivatives, six derivatives, and so on in the entropy, then the argument no longer works because the size of the discontinuity is comparable to the size of those higher order terms. Sorry, the size of the possible decrease in the entropy is comparable to the size of those higher order terms, so the argument no longer works. And so if you take this approach of defining this integral as I've just described, then in an effective field theory setting, there appears to be no constraint coming from the second law on this coefficient gamma. Okay, there's one last thing I'll say something about, which comes back to a question that was asked earlier about an impossible role for the area of this crease submanifold. And this concerns the so-called Busso entropy bound. So let me describe that. A light sheet is a non-expanding null hypersurface ending at a caustic set. That was Busso's original definition. And Busso was motivated by the Bekenstein entropy bound, which in turn was motivated by the generalized second law of black hole mechanics. And he was led to, by trying to make the Bekenstein bound precise, he was led to the following conjecture. Consider a two-dimensional space-like surface of area A, and consider a light sheet emanating orthogonally to it. And the conjecture says that the entropy crossing that light sheet is bounded above by the area in this combination, which is the same as the Bekenstein-Hawking combination. So that was just a conjecture. Very shortly after the conjecture was formulated, it was proved, subject to certain assumptions, by Flanagan, Marolf, and Wald. So what they assumed is that this S on the left-hand side refers to the entropy of matter, and that matter possesses a local entropy current, which is bounded above in terms of the energy momentum tensor in some reasonable way. In other words, a way that's satisfied by all physical forms of matter. They were then able to prove this bound. And in fact, they proved a stronger bound, which is that if you consider a light sheet which terminates, which extends from sigma to some later surface sigma primed, then the entropy is bounded above by the difference of the areas of sigma and sigma primed. Okay. Now, let's say we don't introduce this second surface, and we go back to Boucher's original formulation, which was that you should take this light sheet and keep going as far as possible until you hit a caustic. So Tavakol and Ellis criticized that proposal by saying that the caustic set generally is a very, very complicated thing that's hard to study. As I've explained, in generically, it can be a fractal object. And they argued that a more natural thing to do would be to terminate a light sheet once you reach what I defined earlier, which is the null cut locus of sigma. So that's here, I'm recycling a picture from earlier showing that. So in blue here, think of this as my surface sigma. And here we're considering a path-directed light sheet. So this is my light sheet going to the past from sigma. You can see it's contracting to the past. So we satisfy this non-expanding condition. And then eventually we reach the null cut locus. And the results I described earlier, our results for the null cut locus, told us that generically a null cut locus, not generically, always, a null cut locus has a two-dimensional part, which is the crease submanifold, and then there are lower dimensional things like caustics and corners and so on. So armed with this structure for a general null cut locus, it's then a very straightforward two-line exercise to repeat this Flanagan-Marolf-Wald argument to get another version of the Boussot bound, which now bounds the entropy crossing this light sheet in terms of the difference between the area of the initial surface and twice the area of the crease submanifold. The factor of two comes in because there are two generators of the light sheet going through each point of the crease submanifold. So this is a possible role for this geometrical, this nice geometrical object, this crease submanifold. Okay, I'm sorry I've overrun slightly, so I'll just put up my summary there and I shall end now. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Harvey. So, questions? Okay, I have a question to ask you. So, in the previous slide, are you implying therefore that, for instance, if I have corners, I should add -3 times the area of the corner?
No, because corners don't have area. So they wouldn't appear because they're lower dimensional objects.
I see. So that's why it truncates to the crease.
That's right. Yeah. So there could be corners, and then there will be caustics, but because they don't have area, they won't contribute to the right hand side.
Okay. Thank you. So the two there comes from the two null sheet, two generators coming.
Yeah. As I said, I mean, the proving this is essentially. It's a one line extension of Flanagan, Marolf, and Wald. So it's very, very straightforward once you recognize that. Well, once we have this knowledge about the structure of the null cut locus.
And it's obvious that the crease area is smaller than A over 2.
So that follows from this non expanding condition of the light sheet. So, for example, if this were a black hole horizon, then the area law would guarantee that the area was decreasing to the past, and this would be true for that reason. Or more generally, if you have a ingoing light sheet and you satisfy the null energy condition, then this is going to work.
Okay, other questions, both in the room and online for Harvey?
Just maybe, I don't know, any speculation on more speculation on quantum gravity and or increase or how it should be regulated, or you know, there's a lot of discussion of modular Hamiltonians and operator like that on null sheets. So should these play a role?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think most discussions of black holes in quantum gravity are mainly considering time-independent black holes. The focus is on trying to reproduce the entropy of explicit black hole solutions. And of course, once things become time-dependent, it becomes much harder, both classically and even harder quantum mechanically. So yeah, I'm afraid I don't really have much to say about possible quantum gravity implications of this.
Okay. Maybe on a separate note, a question, Harvey. What happens when I try to describe, so when I push this to an arbitrary surface, null surface, and when I push it to the conformal boundary of the spacetime? So you would say that given some assumption on the structure of the asymptotic structure, you always have regularity, so you never encounter crisis acoustics asymptotically, or do you have some counterexample to that statement? Suppose I talk about scry and I zero.
So you want to consider a cut of scry, is that the idea, and you want to consider the past of that, is it, if I understood
yes.
correctly?
Exactly, yes.
Have I got anything sensible to say about that? Well, I guess in the simplest example, which is Minkowski space-time, then I0 just looks like the vertex of a light cone. So that, I guess, would be an example where I0 is a caustic point from that perspective. But that's only true for Minkowski space-time. And as soon as you put any curvature there, of course, I0 is not a regular point in the conformal compactification. So I guess I would say that would be a case where the space-time itself is not smooth at the point you're interested in. So it's worse than what I'm describing.
But the transverse, the area on the cut, when I go down to I0, is not shrinking to a point, right?
So
there is a crease set there, or am I misunderstanding the definitions?
Well, the area is infinite, of course, because it's a conformal boundary. But I'm just saying, if you look at the conformal compactification of Minkowski space, then you map it to the Einstein cylinder,
yeah.
And in that compactification, future and past null infinity meet at I0, which is just a single point, and I think that the structure there would look like a light cone at that point.
Okay, so that would be the caustic. Okay, yes, thank you. Next. Okay, so if there are no other questions, let's thank Harvey again.